Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll talk with bear expert Elsa Poulsen, author of the book Smiling Bears. We'll talk about her adventures as a zookeeper and her work uncovering the emotional lives of bears. But first, let me play you today's creature call. This week's creature call are the angry sounds of a mammal that lives largely within the Arctic Circle. Now, listen carefully and see if you can guess what it is. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again and tell you what kind of animal made them. Now, let me turn to my conversation about bears with Elsa Poulsen. Few people know bears as intimately as Elsa Poulsen. She has raised bears, comforted bears, taught bears, learned from bears, had bears communicate their needs to her, and nursed bears back to health. With a bachelor's degree in biological sciences, she has worked at the Calgary and Detroit zoos and is known internationally for her captive bear husbandry and rehabilitation. In 2000, she won the Zookeeper Research Excellence Award from the American Zoo and Aquarium Association's Bear Taxon Advisory Group. She currently works as an animal management consultant for zoos, sanctuaries, wildlife rehabilitators, and other animal welfare groups. She lives in southern Ontario. In the 1980s, Poulsen became a zookeeper in Calgary, where she rehabilitated bears in crisis. She has shared in the joy of a polar bear discovering soil under her paws for the first time in 20 years, felt the pride of a cub learning to crack nuts with her molars, and grieved at the horror of captivity for Asian black bears in China. We'll hear about some of her experiences which she's documented in her book, Smiling Bears. Smiling Bears draws on Poulsen's keen scientific background as she shares engaging stories and insights about bear behavior and the emotional lives of bears. When we spoke recently, I asked her how she first got interested in bears.
I tend to think that bears kind of picked me. When I was at the Calgary Zoo, we had a wonderful apprenticeship program. You had to have an undergrad to get into the apprenticeship program, and it was a four-year program, and then you worked with everything from toads to tigers. And as you worked your way through the zoo and learned about the husbandry and natural behavior of all these animals, I found myself understanding large carnivores maybe a little bit better. I could look at a toad and think it was perfectly healthy, and the next day it would have its legs up in the air and be dead. I had no idea. I just didn't have a good feel for how amphibians, for instance, respond. And there are other people who can look at a toad and say, yep, that toad is sick. And but I just didn't have that feel for it. But I did for large carnivores. And over time, I realized that I seemed to understand bears better. So I think it was mutual. I was very interested in them because at the time that I started working in the zoo world was in the 80s, early 80s, and at that time we had bears that paced. People are used to going to zoos, especially in the past, and seeing bears pacing back and forth, and this really bothered me. And people always ask zookeepers who your favorite animal is. For myself and for many other keepers, it's always the animal that needs you the most. If it's a sick animal or an animal that has aberrant behaviors, or an animal that, say, isn't getting along well in the social group that it's in or needs a social group that's specific to that species. So, and that was true for me. And the polar bears that I first started working with, I couldn't get the polar bears out of my mind. We had three at the time in an old enclosure at the Calgary Zoo, which they've since
And what did the formed. Enclosure look like? Because this is the aid in the mid-80s or so?
Right, right. It was cement, solid cement. It was huge. It was built in the early 70s, and at that time, it was considered state-of-the-art. It was a giant pit, and people could go up top and look down into this pit. And it was all cement. There were different levels of it. It was like rolling, tiny little rolling hills of cement. And then there was a huge pool, a 60,000-gallon pool, if I remember correctly. Yeah, it was fresh water. And there was a waterfalls. And the whole cement thing was made to look like the Arctic, because there's lots of waterfalls in the Arctic. I'm just joking. I don't know why we had a big, big waterfall. So there was that white noise of the waterfalls that they were listening to all the time, just thundering. It was a massively huge waterfall. So we had three bears. There was Candy, Missy, and Snowball. And Candy was the older bear, and she had given birth to Snowball, and she had adopted Missy, who was a rescue animal from the wild. She came in at the age of one. And so these three bears would pace collectively as a unit. They would each have their own pacing path, and they paced for much of the day, and it was really disturbing to see these animals pacing back and forth. One would be on the pool wall pacing. They all had their favorite spots. One would be, say, on the pool wall. The other one was at the front windows of the enclosure, and the other one was pacing on the runway at the back of the building. And, it was just really disturbing, and they just spent their day doing this. When I first learned zookeeping, the thinking was we don't want to harm the bears, which was good. That's a good way of thinking. And so we don't want to put natural things in there, like trees and logs and wood chips and all the things that you might see in a good zoo today. We don't want to put those things in there because we could hurt the bear. They could end up with splinters, or they could impact themselves by, say, eating a lot of wood, or they could... And, you know, there were all kinds of reasons as to not putting stuff in there. And zookeepers, though, were kind of an interesting lot because the whole idea of enriching bears and enriching all animals is really came out of zookeepers because they knew that their animals didn't do well in these sterile enclosures. And so they started quietly or sneakily introducing things. And I can remember bringing in live trout for the pool and hoping and praying that polar bears would catch the live trout in this huge pool, or conversely, that no one would see the trout in this huge pool because I would get fired. That was like years ago. And now, of course, things like that are done on a regular basis, enriching the animals' lives. We give them bedding material. Way back when, we were always told, well, you can't put straw in there, you can't put bedding material in there because it'll clog the plumbing. Well, I mean, humans are smart. We could send people to the moon. Surely we can develop plumbing that's going to work with bedding material. Somehow we can keep the bedding material out of the plumbing. And sure enough, we invented ways of dealing with all of that. And we can now introduce things like wood chips and straw bedding and things like that into the enclosures. Bears are genetically, an individual bear, there are really three parts to the personality or three parts that make up an individual bear. Every bear is an individual, just like every human is an individual. And those three parts are genetic programming, so every bear is utterly and completely convinced of being a bear. And polar bears have a genetic expectation to live in an Arctic environment. Sun bears have an expectation to live in the jungle. Panda bears have an expectation to eat bamboo, right? There is definitely bears, there's a nature nurture. So mom fills in the parts. She'll take the youngster around and show the youngster what parts of their environment are useful and how you use it. So that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of making up a bear personality is their personal history. Bears are smart, just like we are, and our personal history has a huge bearing on what we do and how we make decisions. Same thing for bears. And then the last part of what makes up a bear is their current environment, just like with us. We have our history and our genetics, and then our current environment dictates how we use all of those things and how we behave. So, and that's true for bears as well.
And how did you come to think of these three parts to their personality? Because I don't know that most people would think of bears with this distinct parts to their personality, like we do with humans. I mean, it sounds very right. much like humans, where you have your genetics and your, you know, the nature and nurture debate. Has that been a longstanding debate or known in the bear world?
Well, I think the reason I wrote Smiling Bears was to show people just how sentient bears truly are, that every bear is an individual, and just how whole every bear is, that they do have individual personalities, and it's made up of these things. And if people recognize that, of course, then they'll want to conserve bears. It took years for me to come to understand this. I'm very grateful that I started zookeeping in the 80s because it was a transition time. We were transitioning from the old way of thinking to the new way of thinking. And globally, we're starting to view animals differently, and it really started with people like Jane Goodall and Diane Fossey. And we started looking at great apes. Well, we say to ourselves, well, great apes are like us, so surely they're going to be really smart because we're really smart. And, you know, we were able to reach out and extend ourselves a little bit and understand that great apes and chimpanzees might be similar to us. And then we might be able to, you know, at that time stretch it a little bit and say, well, even, you know, small primates might be similar to us, you know, and do things similarly, and they might be smart too. And in the zoo world, that understanding was there thanks to, you know, the tremendous lifetime work of people like Jane Goodall and the shorter lifetime work of Diane Fossey. But then we extended that to elephants. We spent a lot of time with elephants in the zoo community, training elephants, and so we had that human-animal interface. And we learned that keepers learned that elephants are really smart, that they bond with us, that they have needs, and how they interact with their own species and how they interact with us and so on. And so, again, we realized, because we spent time with them, we realized just how smart they were. But initially, as we started extending ourselves to other species, we would say, oh, well, dolphins are really smart. We know that. But and then we said elephants are really smart, and we've kind of moved towards other species. And it's really just time spent, human time spent with the animals. We're discovering, as we spend more time with these animals, that they are, these individual species, really are very smart. They are thinkers. They do problem solve. They do have feelings. They do have social groupings. There is an elephant culture. They have regional culture. They have an overall culture. And it's just time spent. So if you spent a lot of time with badgers, for instance, I think we would learn that badgers are very smart. And it's just time spent. And human beings are... we spent a lot of time at the top of the food chain looking down on all the other species, and we've identified ourselves as being brilliant by negating what other animals can do. So for a while there, we thought, well, we are tool users, animals aren't. Well, we now know that, you know, other animals use tools. And then, well, we have language, animals don't. Well, hello, so do animals. So little by little, we find out that the difference between us as humans and animals is less and less as we get to know all these different species and we do research on it. The animal behavior, or the study of animal behavior, is really in its infancy. And the reason, you wouldn't think that because we've had modern science for quite a while, but it's really our own prejudice and our own need to set ourselves on top of this species hierarchy that has kept us from looking at who and what animals really are. You know, when I started zookeeping, in our society, it wasn't in the early 80s out west. You know, it was zookeeping was very macho. It was mostly men. And they, amongst themselves, didn't talk about animal emotions, because then you would be considered a bunny hugger. And you didn't really interact with your animals, because then you would be a bunny hugger. And this was in the early 80s. And I found that the old guys who'd been doing this for a long time, when I first started as a zookeeper, they became my mentors. When they found out that I wouldn't, when they started telling me about the behaviors, the true behaviors of the animals and their interactions with the animals, and their understanding of the various species that they worked with, if they knew that I wouldn't spread the word that they were actually interacting with the animals and that they were identifying animals as having emotions. And if they knew that I would keep my mouth shut, they would tell me all kinds of information, accurate and good information. But it wasn't okay at that time for men, real men, to be sharing, you know, that kind of information with each other. That's changed now. Also, zookeepers have changed. The vast majority of zookeepers today are women, which is very interesting.
Why is that? That's interesting that it's shifted.
Well, I think, just my own personal opinion is that there's a lot of nurturing going on in zookeeping. It used to be everyone looked at zookeeping from the macho aspect of it, which women do quite well. I mean, there's the macho element where you're throwing bales of alfalfa, and it's physical labor. And I remember working the large mammal section, which I loved, with rhinos, hippos, and giraffes that we had at the Calgary Zoo. And physically, that was a very... Rhino poop is not small.
How big is it?
Yeah. And about the size of a bowling ball, and there's not just one, right? And so the point being that you're, you know, shoveling... I was never in such great shape as whenever I worked on the large mammal section. The same for, you know, elephants. And I worked elephants for a while, too. So there was a real macho element to that because there was tough physical labor and that kind of thing. But there's also a real nurturing aspect to the job, caring for animals. And I think that could be what's really appealing to women. I don't know. That's just my own personal opinion about it. It just really seems to... There is another aspect to it as well, and that is that you don't go into zookeeping to make a lot of money. It's not usually very well paid unless you work at a big city zoo and are unionized and you have a good package. So that may or may not appeal to men. That would be my assessment, that it's a nurturing thing more so than anything else.
And to go into zookeeping, what kind of education or background do you need? And has that changed over time?
It has changed over time, actually. Both in Canada and the United States, there are now college and university courses in zookeeping. At the time when I started, in the early 80s, I don't believe that there were any college or university courses in it. There was, at the Calgary Zoo, our director, Peter Karsten, was a zookeeper from Germany. And in Germany, they still have an extensive, active apprenticeship program for zookeepers. And so Peter brought that experience to the Calgary Zoo and developed this four-year apprenticeship program. And over time, it developed into... the criteria to get into that program was that you had to have an undergrad degree in order to even get in. And so, you know, you had that and in some aspect of, you know, the natural sciences. And then you would do this four-year apprenticeship program. And really, it was like boot camp. And I, at the time, I thought, oh, no, this is, it absorbs your whole life. But it's, in my opinion... It's really the only way to learn zookeeping, to go in with a good basic knowledge of the natural sciences and then to go in and work with the animals and learn as you go. So the apprenticeship program, at that time, the zoo was divided into units or zones, I guess. And you, as an apprentice, would work your way. You'd spend 4 months in each area. And in that 4 months, you had to do a written exam. You had to write a paper on some aspect of the section that you were working on, and you had to do an oral exam, and that's what put hair on your chest.
Really?
Anything at that time when I did the apprenticeship program, anything was game. There was a veterinarian, a couple of your bosses, actually three of your bosses at the different levels. There would be the head section keeper and then one of your... the equivalent of a curator, and then sometimes the director of animal collections would be there, and a veterinarian, and they would ask you, obviously they wouldn't ask you strict medical questions, because that's not what zookeeping's all about, but anything from Latin names to behavior to catch up, and that was part of it. You had to catch up an animal in a safe manner as part of your oral exam. I remember sweating buckets for these oral exams. You didn't want to look stupid, and you studied and studied. Of course, you had to work at the same time, right? So it was your whole life at that time. And I was very grateful for that whole it's really what launched me into doing research and going to conferences and meeting other people and becoming actively involved in the American Zoological Association's bear tag taxon advisory group conferences and stuff. And just meeting other people in other zoos and starting to share information has been huge for every species in the zoo world when we share our information. You know, it in terms of developing modern husbandry techniques and so on. There's a movement now that's been going on, some are more progressive than others, that's been going on for the last 10 or 15 years in terms of husbandry, and it's behavior-based husbandry. In other words, you recognize that a species is genetically programmed to expect certain things from their environment. And if you take those aspects that are essential to them from their natural environment and do your level best to bring that into the captive community and offer that to them, then any bear will set up their own daily routine. Just like humans, bears in the wild have their own daily routine. They make day beds, they make dens, they check out their favorite feeding sites depending on what's seasonally available. Within their home range, they know that, okay, the berries are over here in the home range and the salmon are over here. And in whatever season, the salmon spawn in whatever season, the berries are ripe, so we go there. If you happen to be a Montana grizzly, you climb to the top of this particular mountain because the moth larvae, the big, fat, juicy moth larvae are ready to be eaten, and there's thousands of them because that's the way it was last year. And so we'll climb up there, you know, same time as last year. So bears have daily routines and they have seasonal routines. And if you provide your bears in the captive environment with the essential elements of their expectations, then they will utilize those, and you will be housing mentally and physically healthy bears.
So when you first meet a bear, what do you do?
In the wild?
Yeah, actually, let's start with in the wild and then in a captive setting.
I always tell people, I do a lot of speaking engagements, and that because I'm Canadian, and when I do the speaking engagements here in Canada, every Canadian has a bear story. We have a lot of bears up here, so everybody wants to know, what do you do? And I always say, you basically deal with bears the way that they deal with each other. You're going to meet one of two types of bears. You're either going to meet the defensive bear, which is a bear who's defending maybe young or a carcass or a bunch of berries, or you surprise the bear and just the bear just doesn't want you around, which is obviously understandable. Or you're going to meet a predatory bear. And the predatory bear is a bear that's going to try to get you, to eat you, whether you run, back away, whatever you do. The predatory bear is more rare, meeting a bear that actually wants to feed off of you. That's quite rare. Excuse me. And most times that you meet a bear in the wild, it's going to be a defensive bear. And the best thing to do is deal with it the way that bears deal with each other. If two bears meet each other and don't want to have anything to do with each other, and I've watched this over years, they just back away from each other. Their eyes remain glued to each other. They have each other's attention. But backing away from each other, it's just a show that I'm backing away now, and I'm respecting your space, and then I'm going to move off. The last thing you want to do is turn and run and look like food. So just back away from the bear and then turn when you're at, you know, safe distance away, and then turn and walk away, obviously keeping your eyes on where that animal is. A predatory bear doesn't really care if you're backing away. A predatory bear is going to get you no matter what. So that's when you climb trees. Acting like you're dead on the ground is not necessarily a good thing for a predatory bear, because they just don't care. They're going to want to eat you no matter what. So they're really, and the big question becomes, how do I know when I'm facing a predatory bear as opposed to a defensive bear who's just being aggressive? Bears do what's called a bluff charge, and which very much looks like a real charge. And but then they back off just before the impact kind of thing, just to let you know that they don't want you there. And it's difficult to know, obviously. A bear that's bluff charging removes him or herself from the area after they've bluff charged you, and a predatory bear doesn't. So
so you really find out later.
Well, yeah, you know, you find out in the thick of things. The predatory bear, for them, it's about hunting. I've noticed this when I watch both bears in captivity and in the wild. A bear that's hunting, there's no emotion attached to that. It's simply all about process and predation. So technique. If I do X, Y, Z, then I can bring down this deer or whatever it is that they're hunting. And there's no emotion attached to it. And that's what hunting is, right? A predatory bear is a hunting bear. So a predatory bear will often head straight for you and simply not take their eyes off of you or do anything else. A defensive bear, like a female with cubs, may or may not round up the cubs first. If she has an older cub, she may bring the cub with her to bluff charge you, or she may shoot her, if she's got tiny cubs, she may shoot them up a tree first, let them know to go up a tree, and then, you know, go after you. But, and sometimes bluff charges, a bear will literally run you over and stomp on you as they are bluff, which does seem like an attack to humans. And they could bite your ankles or give you a bite. And as humans, we think of that as, we often confuse that with predation, when in fact it's not a hunting bear, it's still a defensive bear who's telling you that they don't want to be around. So always, when you meet a bear, just back away from the bear. Just get out of there.
Have you ever met a predatory bear?
No, I've personally never met a predatory bear. I've been bluff charged, and you can stand your ground. And it worked out. I don't know what to tell you. I'm still here. But I've seen the hunting. I've observed it. The hunting behaviors in captivity, and also I've seen it on video and so on. And there just seems to be no emotion involved, and certainly a defensive bear. There's anger and annoyance. There's emotion involved. There's lots of talking and jaw snapping and spitting and, you know, owly behavior. And the hunting bear doesn't really waste time with any of that because they're not angry. They're just hunting, right?
How have you uncovered the emotion life of bears? Just been talking a little bit about, you know, anger and annoyance and signs of that. What are some behaviors that you've seen, and how did you uncover them?
It's taken a lot of time. It's time spent knowing bears personally in the captive community. And it's happened little by little. It's embarrassing to say, but it took me several years of working around bears before I understood, for instance, that they smile. And bears smile just like we do. They pull each side of their mouth upwards. And they smile for bear reasons of self-contentment, just like we as humans smile for human reasons of self-contentment. So, but those reasons might not be the same. In one case, for instance, a human mom will smile if her child does something that she finds funny and so on. A bear mom will smile if her cubs do something cute or something that she finds, you know, that contentment in. So that's a similarity. But in other cases, you know, that grizzly bear in Montana might be smiling when he reaches the top of the mountain and finds, you know, thousands and thousands of larvae up there that he can eat. I wouldn't be smiling about that. I don't really care about that. I would maybe be interested that there are thousands of larvae up there, but I'm not going to eat them. So it doesn't mean anything to me. So bears express emotion based on what matters to them in their bear world. And it takes time. It takes time just the same as it takes time for you to learn your dog's behavior and your cat's behavior. It takes repetition. And I would often set the situation up if there's a particular behavior I hadn't seen before or something. You know, sometimes you see behaviors, but it doesn't really register with you until a certain incident, and then it registers with you, oh, I've seen that before. And repetition is very important, so you can set up a scenario and see if you see that behavior again. I think we're used to seeing anger and annoyance. We get that. Intrinsically, we get anger and annoyance in a bear. The bear is growling or spitting or standing on his hind legs and giving you the evil eye and you know, maybe batting in the air or something like that. We're used to seeing it in the movies. And it's funny, we allow animals to have feelings of anger and annoyance. We get that, but we've, as a society, been slow to allow animals to have feelings, the converse feelings, right, of love and like, happiness, joy, those kinds of things. We think, no, only humans have those feelings, but animals, yeah, we get that they can be angry because we've seen it when the bear comes barreling at you and he's, you know, gnashing his teeth and spitting at you. Clearly, you get instinctively that this animal's ticked off. Yeah. So, but it's what we've been slow to accept as a society is that they also have other feelings of the positive, the more or the converse feelings of anger and annoyance, and I want to hurt you, right? Funny thing. And I think it's because we haven't had the opportunity to spend lots of time with particular species like carnivores to see them in those calmer, sort of joyful moments. We do get, though, one of the first sort of joyful or sensitive feelings that we allow, that we interpret and allow bears to have is we understand the mother-cub bond. We somehow get that the female looks after her cubs, that she's a good mother in that she's constantly looking after her cubs and showing them the environment and touching them and playing with them and that kind of thing, and she's smiling when she's doing it. So we allow ourselves to infer that therefore she has some feeling for the cubs. Again, it's the human agenda that dictates what feelings we allow animals to have and what feelings we don't allow them to have.
And pacing, when you were talking about pacing earlier, I mean, some people in a zoo situation and you go to the zoo and you see the animal pacing, you think, oh good, it's moving, you know, it's interested in people. And you knew it was a sign of distress. How did you come to that conclusion?
Well, I think when I first saw it, it made no sense to me. When I started as a zookeeper, the pacing made no sense to me. It's called a seriotypy, and it seemed like that repetitive behavior had no purpose. I also, though, had seen pacing or repetitive behaviors in friends. But funny thing, I didn't connect the two at first, but I couldn't get these polar bears out of my mind. I would go home and I would worry about them, think about them, and wonder, okay, why is this happening and how are we going to make it stop so that they can turn around and pay attention to what's going on around them. And it was at the same time that people were starting to talk about natural habitats and bringing bits of the wild into this big cement pit that we had just talked about, and enrichment and that kind of thing. So one thing kind of built on the next. But I think the key to my concern was I would ask other folks who had been watching these bears pace for years and ask just, why are they doing that, hoping for some sort of an answer? And I was told that polar bears, walk great distances in the wild, so therefore they pace in captivity. Now, the pacing behavior itself, the behavior itself, or the gait itself, looks nothing like a normal walking gait. So a true stereotypy with repetitive behaviors, for instance, a bear can walk 6 steps in one direction and then turn around, maybe do a head swing at the end of the 6 steps or 7 or 8 steps, do a head swing and then turn around and walk back 6 steps. And then when they repeat that cycle, their paws will fall in exactly the same place on the first outbound trip. And so the way I actually discovered that was because was before I even had a video camera to do this. I had a camera, and I fired off a series of shots. I just kept firing off my camera of this one polar bear that we had who was pacing on top of the pool. And interestingly enough, the pool wall had lines going up and down. So I was able to plant, you know, and I just kept firing off shots. This was in the days of film. Before digital, it cost me a fortune. And I would fire off all of these shots every second or, as soon as the camera was ready to take the next picture. And then I went and had all of these pictures processed, and I stuck them up on boards, and I was able to assess that those paws on the outbound, on all the outbound trips, fell in, because of the lines in the cement, I was able to determine that they fell in exactly the same location. And on the inbound trips, again, the paws fell, the same paw fell in exactly the same. And that's not a normal walking gait. And then I just kept observing these animals, and there was actually sort of an Oprah aha moment. I remember it was really, Calgary gets really cold, and I was there, I think it was like 5 o'clock in the morning, and it was fall, and I was just freezing, and I was watching these bears pace back and forth, and I wasn't getting anywhere. I put so much time into this, and I was starting to feel sorry for myself, and all my digits were frozen, and here I was writing down. Now we have now we can record, on a tape recorder, our thoughts, but oh no, I'm writing this stuff down. And I had to go into the building. I was just freezing. And in the building, there were also windows, and I was watching this bear pace, and I was just completely and utterly desperate. And I thought, okay, I'm going to pace, because I don't know what this animal is doing. I don't know what this animal is feeling. And I thought the only way I'm ever going to know is to try it. So I tried to pace. And I actually had to count six paces forward, turned around, six paces back, turned around, six paces forward. And I made myself, initially I was counting paces, everybody can try this at home, over a very short period of time, you automatically start pacing, your body just automatically starts pacing a certain number of steps in one direction, certain number of steps back. And your mind starts going to other places, and you start to think about other things. And I felt at that time a small sense of euphoria, too, which told me that my biochemistry had changed. Now, the pacing, what triggered, in my personal opinion, that change for me, now in retrospect after we did the research on Snowball, wasn't the same thing as her pacing. But what it told me was, at the time that I was doing this, that there was biochemistry involved. And so that's when I went to the university, and I got in touch with a neuroscientist, Tam Teske, who was wonderful. He was at the University of Calgary at the time. He may still be there. And we sat down, and I thought to myself, I'm going to tell him what I think, and then he's going to tell me I'm crazy. And that'll be okay, because I don't know him. I'll be embarrassed for a little while, and then it'll be over. That's honestly what I thought. I thought, I have to go through this process, though, because this is what I think. And and at that time, too, I had thought of a friend of mine who had obsessive-compulsive disorder. Is it Lady Macbeth who used to wash her hands ceaselessly? I can't remember. One of Shakespeare's characters had obsessive-compulsive disorder after she
murdered. So you're thinking, at this point, you're actually thinking that Snowball has a mental disorder.
Yes. Well, I thought she had a biochemistry thing going on. I didn't really know. But I was thinking that it was similar to what my friend had, which was obsessive-compulsive disorder. Just like Lady Macbeth, who would not stop washing her hands, and she had to continuously wash her hands. And my friend had this issue with continuously washing his hands and could not make that stop, and I knew he wasn't crazy. I knew there was something going on with him that he could not make that stop, and later on we found out that it's an information transfer issue in the brain. And so anyway, I had all these ideas, which could have been considered pretty crazy. I went and told Tam about them. My first meeting with him, and I was shocked when he didn't tell me to leave his office. And he said, yep, I think there's something to this, and now we have to test it.
So how do you test that on a bear?
Well, we set up an ABA test where we first monitored her behaviors to find out what exactly her stereotypy looked like, the pacing behavior looked like. And then we looked at if she does have something, an affective disorder similar to human obsessive compulsive disorder, how are we treating that in humans? Well, at that time, they were using fluoxetine, which is better known as Prozac. And we thought, well, we will then, the B part of it is to put her on this drug, find a therapeutic dose, and then if if you actually are able to affect her behavior and make that go away, then you take the drug away to see if, you know, that would be the last part of it, to see if her behavior comes back. And then you can say that fluoxetine actually somehow positively affected, you know, the behavior. So Cam set that aspect of it up, and I started running around getting cameras, video cameras, and setting all that up. The first thing we had to do was get our zoo management on board, and they were wonderful. They really were concerned. We had at that time just wonderful folks in management who really cared about the polar bears and wanted to fix the problem. And
was it the pacing? Was it just Snowball, or it was all three that were pacing? It was Snowball, Misty, and Candy.
Candy had passed away at that point, so there was just Snowball and Misty. And Misty at that time paced seasonally. So it was Snowball who was, Misty would go through periods where she didn't pace at all. And, but Snowball, it was Snowball that we focused on, that we did the work on. And we were able to break down the pacing behavior. We found that she had the repetitive disorder of pacing back and forth. She also had a facial tic. And which exhibited itself only during the pace, when she was pacing back and forth on the pool wall. She had one other behavior. Was that Snowball or was that Misty? It was actually Misty. We did work on Misty later. Misty showed one other behavior, and that was that she would dive into the pool. She would pace. Misty's pacing was more manic. I'm not using that clinically. I'm just using that as it was really fast, and it was nonstop, and they would go on and on for days when she did pace. And she would cool herself off and drink water and urinate all at the same time. She would run, while she'd be pacing at the front of the enclosure, she would run to the back, dive into the pool, presumably to cool off. She would urinate in the pool, which you could see as she was swimming across the pool, and drink water. it was just a remarkable. And then she would pop out at the other end of the pool and run back down to the front of the enclosure and then pace back and forth. So obviously, you know, this bear had serious issues as well. But with Snowball, I did a couple of things to try and understand whether there was a compulsive aspect to this. In other words, when Snowball paced, was she aware of the world around her, or what you could say, was she zoned out? Was she completely unaware of the world around her, and she was just motoring back and forth? And there seemed to be, I did a couple of experiments with her. We did enrichment, and she had some favorite things that she liked. She would like puzzle feeders, and she liked watermelons in the pool, like whole watermelons in the pool, and other things like that. So what I would do is, I thought, the theory was, if she wasn't obsessive-compulsive, then if you provide her with lots of interesting things to do or things to do, then she would do those things. And so with Snowball, I would start right when I got there in the morning and would do one enrichment activity after another, all fun things that she liked. When she'd finished with that one, walked away from it, I'd run up there and give her something else that she really liked to do, and she would participate in that for a while. And then when she walked away from that one, I would run up there and give her something else. It was really time-consuming. And so, but it was, I was determined to find out the nature of her behavior. And I found out that with Snowball, there was a ceiling, the number of activities that she could participate in before she absolutely had to go back and pace. And that was interesting. There was maybe four activities or five activities, sometimes just three activities, and then she would go back to the, so she'd do the first activity and go pace on her, and then I'd run down there and give her something else. She'd come off her pacing pathway, take part in the second activity, then she'd go back to pacing. I'd run down there, give her something else, but there was a point at which she could not pull herself off of that pacing pathway in order to do something else. She had to pace. So I thought, okay, that's what it seemed like. Is she aware of her environment? Does she even know now that she's pacing, does she know that I'm giving her other things to do? Because if she's not aware of it, then we're in a whole different ballgame here. So I thought, well, how am I going to determine awareness? Her all-time favorite food was ice cream. And we would use that to give her drugs, you know, ice
cream.
How
did you discover that?
Well, you know, when your bear has an issue or your animal has an issue and the veterinarian hands you a bunch of drugs, you have to find a way of getting that drug into that animal. So you learn that something like ice cream, you just go through all the different peanut butter, ice cream, honey, you know, all the different treat items that you have that they don't normally get in their daily diet but would really like. So we discovered that way that ice cream was the number one primo treat. So what I did
vanilla?
Was... Pardon me?
Vanilla?
Yeah, vanilla. It was vanilla. She was, as funny thing, she didn't like strawberry that much, and we never did do chocolate. But, yeah, it was just funny. Yeah, it was vanilla. And so what I did was, knowing that that was her favorite thing, she would come, whatever she was doing, she would leave it to go have ice cream. So what I did, again, this was an experiment, I would start the day with, and you know, her favorite enrichment, and then she would go back, enrichment event number one, she would take part in it, then she would go pace, I'd immediately go there with number two, event number two, she would go and take part in it, event number three, we'd get to the point where we'd hit the ceiling, right, where she could not move herself, or it seemed like she could not move herself off that pacing pathway. And then I felt evil doing this, but I went upstairs to the top roof of the enclosure, and I made ice cream balls the size of like a big baseball. And I would throw them, drop them into the enclosure just off of her pacing pathway so that she would have to step off the pathway to get the ice cream so that I knew for sure that she was seeing it. And so if she was seeing it, she would step off the pathway too. And I had no real idea. Again, it was an experiment to see, to get an idea of what this behavior was all about. And this broke my heart. I remember clearly she was pacing back and forth. It was a hot summer's day, and the ice cream balls were melting under the sun and, you know, kind of dripping away. And she was looking at them, and I was calling her name, trying to call her off the pathway and show her. She was looking at the ice cream balls, and I thought to myself, I wonder if she gets it. And that's when I saw her drooling, and I knew that she was recognizing the ice cream balls because she was drooling.
Huh.
Yeah, and that's when I realized.
And did she did not step off the pathway?
No. And she was drooling. And this, I mean, clearly this animal normally didn't drool unless there was something, you know, really wonderful food or something like that. But she could not, and that's when I knew it was compulsive. She could not get off, she couldn't get off that pacing pathway. After we had reached the ceiling of enrichment items, she had to pace. And not even to go get ice cream. And that's when I realized, yeah, we're on the right path here. She has something similar to obsessive compulsive disorder, and she cannot make this stop. And we were successful with the fluoxetine. It was the best drug on the market at the time, and because it affected only the serotonergic system. And so we were successful with it. That's since been repeated. There are some other folks who have done a similar work with a grizzly bear and had success with that. And I know that fluoxetine is sometimes prescribed for companion animals who have obsessive compulsive disorder like symptoms. So, yeah, that was that work.
And now that event took the media by storm, really.
It did. Yes, it did.
And And I know that from your book, Smiling Bears, you mentioned that David Letterman, the David Letterman show, had asked you to be on, and you declined.
Well, I didn't. I didn't know about it at the time. The zoo declined. And I think that was probably a good idea because I love David Letterman. I've been watching him for years, and he's hilariously funny. And that's, just personally, I think he's hilarious. And at the time, I watched Letterman too. But I don't think that there was a lot of, at that time, I don't know that it's so much so now. I think there's more understanding now about diseases like obsessive compulsive disorder. But at that time, there was a real stigma attached to both Prozac and to obsessive compulsive disorder. So it was really a double whammy for the poor people who suffered from OCD. They had to first hide it from the rest of the world because the rest of the world, including family members, as I learned by talking to a lot of folks who had OCD, people thought that they were nuts. There was this label, you're crazy because you're continuously washing your hands or you count things, I don't know, you say 7, 8, 9 as you're going up the stairs or something like that. There are many expressions of obsessive compulsive disorder. And not only was there a stigma towards the disease, now there was a stigma towards the drug that could help you, which was fluoxetine. So it was a real double whammy. And the interesting thing is, I was concerned when it went public. Eli Lilly, they were really good to us. They gave us the drug. You can imagine it's a polar bear, so that drug was going to cost a fair bit of money in order to even do the research. And they were really wonderful with us. They gave us the drug, and they were interested in the research that we produced and so on. And my reason for doing this, and Dr. Kamteski's reason, and the zoo's reason for doing this was simply to help the bears. And if we could help bears elsewhere, in the zoo world and the captive community, then that would be good. It did end up in the media, and it went worldwide. It was sort of a sexy title, Polar Bears on Prozac. There was even a cartoonist whose name I forget now, in Toronto, might have been the Globe and Mail, who did a series of four different cartoons where the keeper, which would be myself, is depicted as a little man in a little zookeeper suit. And he had polar bears and penguins mixed up, and it was kind of a take on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that kind of a, we're going to now give you drugs and keep you drugged up. So there was a complete lack of understanding of how fluoxetine actually works. Fluoxetine simply, to use Kamteski's words, completes the information transfer in the brain. My understanding of the neuroscience behind it is that for instance, a human being who repeatedly washes his hands feels there's a message in the brain saying that your hands are dirty. So, and this happens to all of us, obviously. So you go and you wash your hands. Well, the act of washing your hands, at the sake of oversimplifying all of this, the act of washing your hands shuts down that message to wash your hands, right? So, and that's kind of a loop of information. Well, if there's a break in that loop of information, then the person who's washing their hands, the information never gets back into the brain that you've now washed your hands and they are clean, you can stop doing it. And in speaking to people who have obsessive compulsive disorder, they tell me that they cannot get that message into their head that their hands are now clean. They know logically that their hands are clean, but they can't shut the message down. And it's just horrible for them. I didn't know a lot. I knew one person who had obsessive compulsive like disorder symptoms. I didn't know a lot of people. But when it went worldwide on the papers and so on, it was remarkable. People that I didn't know came to me in the zoo. And, I spent a lot of time watching these bears and doing observations and stuff. And they came up and said, "Are you the person, doing this work?" And I'd say, "Yeah." And they would tell me their personal stories about obsessive compulsive disorder. And it was very humbling that a complete stranger would tell me their personal story about it. And I was struck by that. And I was also struck by the fact that if they're telling me about it, to the depth that they were telling me about it, it meant that there was no one else, even in their family, that they could talk to that didn't think they were nuts. And that struck me as well. So it was a real, it was very humbling to me. an honoring that they would do that, that they would tell you. And presumably they did, because they didn't know me and it was safe, and they knew I didn't know them, and I wasn't going to hurt them in their life. I couldn't, you know, tell other people that they knew and so on. It was safe to tell me.
In essence, some of these people started taking medicine to deal with their own illness.
Yeah, there were folks already doing fluoxetine, and then there were folks that hadn't been, and so were going back to their doctors. And Foothills Hospital had a wonderful unit, I can't remember the name of it at the moment, that we also went to talk about these disorders. And so I could tell them, well, we're talking to the folks, there were particular folks that we were working with, him and I, to discuss these disorders with. And so I would say, you know what, maybe give these people a call, this clinic a call, or the Foothills Hospital in Calgary, and they can help you. So yeah, they would go and do that, and presumably, hopefully, help themselves that way. I do remember, I heard this a number of times, but I can clearly remember the first time I heard this. It was a woman who told me this, that I didn't know, and we'd had a heart-to-heart, even though I didn't know her, about this. And she was actually just standing there watching the bears, and I had a few minutes, and I went over there, and I thought, well, I'm going to explain the behavior, because I wanted her to know that the zoo was doing something for this. I didn't want her to just, I frequently did that. We all did in the zoo. We would try and interpret behaviors and just let them know that we do know it's happening, we're doing the best we can, and here's what we think's going on, and here's what we're trying. You know, information is important in the zoo world to the public. So I went over to talk to her, and she was a person who had obsessive compulsive disorder, and so we started talking, and she said to me, at some point, she said to me, you know, I always had in the back of my mind an element. She said, everybody thinks I'm crazy, so I stopped telling people. But I always had an element in the back of my head wondering if I've lost my marbles, if it's my fault. And then she said, but here's a bear doing it, and I know it's not the bear's fault. So therefore, it's not my fault. I almost cried.
Wow.
Yeah.
I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation about bears with bear expert Elsa Poulsen, author of Smiling Bears. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. This week's creature call comes from a mammal that lives largely within the Arctic Circle. It comes from one of the 8 bear species that we've talked about today. Do you know it yet? It's the polar bear. Listen to the sounds of an angry polar bear. Archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com. The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.